It's about affiliates and sponsors. Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky in the studio, 303-696-1971. Our phone number here, my email, ross@backboneradio.net. And if you want to send me an instant message, you can go to my website at rossputin.com, and there'll be a little box over on the right side. You can send me a message. And we have the distinct privilege of being joined by Bert and Anita Folsom. Bert is a professor of history at Hillsdale College. Anita also works at Hillsdale College. And they have recently written a book called FDR Goes to War. Came out just less than 3 months ago. Bert also wrote a book called New Deal or Raw Deal. And we'll probably get into some of those topics during the hour. Oh, my goodness. I have to just interrupt here. If I just saw that right, the Denver Broncos just had something like a 90 or something yard play to win the game in overtime against the Pittsburgh Steelers. I can't believe it. All right. Sorry, Bert and Anita, for that.
Quite all right.
Unbelievable. The Broncos were an 8-point underdog in this game. Okay. So as we think, what I'd like to ask you to do here first is kind of set the stage. What was FDR looking at? What was the domestic scene, first of all, as we were drifting into World War II? Let's start with the domestic side. What was FDR dealing with?
You have to consider, Ross, and I know you know this, that the New Deal had not ended the Great Depression at all. In fact, we still had 20% unemployment in 1939, and that's the year that World War II broke out in Europe. So the United States was operating in world affairs from a position of weakness. We are a weak economy. In fact, the average unemployment in the European nations was 11%. And this is before the wartime jobs pulled unemployment made it better in Europe. We had 20%. Europe had 11%. The Great Depression was hitting the United States harder because of Franklin Roosevelt's policies. We get into that in the book New Deal or Raw Deal. Now, so that gets us to the war. We're operating from a position of weakness. FDR, the next thing to keep in mind is that FDR was inflating all sorts of social policy here for jobs for the WPA to try to give jobs, often subsidies to win votes. But he was not building the military. So the military was totally unprepared for World War II. We did not have enough planes. We didn't have enough tanks. General MacArthur talked about how we only had enough ammunition to last for a month or two. And so the military was very unprepared for World War II. So here we're going in militarily unprepared, and we're in the midst of a Great Depression.
So one thing that jumps out at me there is, you know, the military has all kinds of, you know, fighting tools and weapons, but they don't make those things themselves. And FDR had spent the better part of a decade attacking capitalists and capitalism every step of the way. So how did we get from a place where the president was assaulting industry at every turn to a place where industry was willing and able to provide what America needed to win a war?
It took several steps, Ross. First of all, you're right, FDR had attacked business for the first 7 years of his presidency. And then when the Germans under Hitler were rolling through Holland and Luxembourg and France in May of 1940, Roosevelt knows that now the Western powers are going to have to rearm, and the U.S. is going to have to do a great deal of it. He goes on the radio, and he pivots his entire presidency away from attacking business in a speech on May 26, 1940, and he says, from now on, we are going to partner with business, and we need your help. And he actually has the government guarantee that they will help industry to build war plants. Industry can take the tax deductions over a period of only 5 years rather than having to spread them out over 20 years. He gives industry many incentives, and he has to do that suddenly in 1940. Now, he's not going to do it for forever, but he does it from about 1940 until about 1944, and then he starts attacking business again. But that's how he turns around the American industrial scene.
Now, FDR came out of the same progressive mindset as Woodrow Wilson and the early progressives, who were famously not very interested in getting involved in wars overseas. So did FDR share that mindset in his core, or did he actually want to go to war for principled reasons versus, let's say, you know, did he feel like with unemployment as high as it was, he had political risk unless he distracted the population with something else?
Well, Roosevelt's a very complex individual. Now, there's one thing for sure, is he had absolutely no hesitation about barging into any kind of a conflict. He was a tinkerer and a meddler. He believed that he could always straighten out domestic problems. He didn't look at the results. He just believed he could. And he really wasn't very accountable to the American people. But from the earliest days of his presidency in 1933, he was talking privately with advisors about getting into some sort of a conflict with Japan because of what they were doing in the Pacific. So he was very unlike a lot of the progressives in that he actually was sort of a war hawk. But part of that was he wasn't going to be out in the trenches fighting. He wasn't going to be in a foxhole. He was going to sit grandly at the top and direct everyone else, and that's the idea that he had.
Very interesting. So, you know, what I think one of the major theses in your book, and we sort of started to touch on it here, but, people love FDR still to this day, and it still drives me nuts that they do, but you know, one of the real theses in your book, FDR Goes to War, and again, people go to Amazon.com and check out FDR Goes to War. You're going to want to buy this book and read it, as well as Burt's previous book, New Deal or Raw Deal. But your thesis is that really the American people won this war. Can you, you know, flesh that out a little bit more for us?
It's a good point. I want to give FDR the credit here. Anita had just said in when we were speaking before that he did make arrangements with business people to give them various incentives. In other words, he said, we'll help build your factories. We promise to buy what you produce. We'll promise to pay a certain amount for the products that you're making. So that, in other words, he gave incentives for business people to actually go ahead, which is good because all of a sudden we're going to get some inventions that we should have had, by the way, 10 years earlier. We get developments in radar. We get developments with the invention and expansion of penicillin. We get a variety of dehydrated foods to feed the Army. All of these kinds of innovations, some of which are very important today, finally occurred in World War II. We could have perhaps have had them earlier. But yeah, Roosevelt is someone determined to, at one level, he's determined to launch into the war try to make it successful. But at the other end, as you say, it's the American people in the sense that the soldiers have to buy into the cause. They have to believe in what we're doing. We got attacked at Pearl Harbor, Ross. It's much different from, the current generations. Anywhere under 60 years old, you don't remember a war in which we were directly attacked. You remember Korea, maybe, or Vietnam, or Iraq. Those are all overseas wars that are very different in U.S. history.
We remember 9/11, though. How would you compare that?
Yeah, now that's true. We were attacked, but then we don't really have a country that attacked us. But we did do a counterattack. That's a good parallel. But here with Pearl Harbor being attacked, we knew the nation that attacked us, they were going to be there the next day, and we had to, and then Germany declared war on us too. So that we had nations who declared war directly, who declared war on us, and then the American people bought into it in the sense that the soldiers had to go out. They had to go into the foxholes. They had to train. The military people had to have we had to choose, General Marshall and others had to choose the right people to help lead them. But Americans had to go into the trenches and do the job and have the will to win, because without that, we never would have been able to prevail.
We only have about 30 seconds left in this segment. Was there a draft at the time?
There was a draft beginning in the fall of 1940, It was actually the first peacetime draft in the United States history.
So what percentage of our fighting forces, if you know, during World War II were drafted versus were volunteers?
That would vary from service to service. It would be much higher volunteer rate in the Marines, of course, but the overwhelming majority would have been drafted.
Would have been drafted. All right, when we come back, Bert and Anita Folsom, authors of FDR Goes to War, I want to talk to you a little bit about once we got into the war, how did FDR use the fact that we were in war to expand his own powers, and what's the long-run impact of that? Bert and Anita Folsom from Hillsdale College, stay with us right here on Backbone Radio on News Talk 710 KNUS. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky in studio. News Talk 710 KNUS and 1460 KZNT. I just really have to say again, congratulations to the Denver Broncos beating the Pittsburgh Steelers in overtime with these new overtime rules that I'm not going to get into right now because this is not a football show, and we have a sports show coming up right after Backbone Radio, so they'll cover all of that. But boy, that was just amazing. The Denver Broncos, 8-point or something around an 8-point underdog at home. We are joined by Bert and Anita Folsom from Hillsdale College. Their book, FDR Goes to War, get on Amazon.com, type that in, FDR Goes to War, buy the book and read it. You will learn a lot. Now, before we get into the issue of FDR using the war to expand government, my friend Fred, a military who served some time in the reserves, right? And a very smart guy all around, has a history question for you, which is good since you guys are historians. So jump right
sure.
in, Fred.
Yeah, thanks, Ross. So my question's very very quick. So as I understand, based on your earlier comments, FDR sort of declared a truce with American industry so that wartime production could be ramped up. But what I'm wondering about is, I think in March of 1941, Roosevelt signed the Lend-Lease Act to provide material and support to China and Britain initially, and then this was expanded to the Soviet Union. Where was this material coming from, and was it real, or was it really, were they getting seconds and thirds from the U.S., because we didn't have a whole lot of war material to ship in the first place?
You're right, Fred. We didn't have much war material to ship out at first. The Lend-Lease Act that was signed in March of 1941 gave Roosevelt huge power. It gave him the power to allocate any supplies we already had, and it gave him power to distribute anything that was made in the future. Now, that's a lot of power to a U.S. president. And what Roosevelt did was he actually was stripping the U.S. forces in the first few months of armaments. We had three ships. We mentioned this in our book, FDR Goes to War. Three ships that we mentioned by name went to sea in 1941, and the crews had never had gunnery practice because there weren't any shells. When it came to anti-aircraft guns, by the time of Pearl Harbor, FDR had given away 1,900 anti-aircraft guns. He gave 1,500 to England and 400 to other countries. Now, those had to be made mostly in 1941, but the big bottleneck, the biggest bottleneck certainly in 1940, was black powder and gunpowder, smokeless powder. And because the U.S. was only producing enough powder to produce weapons for 100,000 soldiers a month. And so that was a huge bottleneck, and as General Marshall said one time when asked, he said it wouldn't do any good to send people weapons right now because we don't have the shells for them. So you ask a good question. FDR not only stripped the U.S. military of supplies in the spring of 41, but he was pushing, and a huge percentage of what was coming out of American factories was going overseas.
Now, did England make their own black powder and smokeless powder?
Well, they would have, yes, they had their own manufacture of much of that, but then you get down into questions of quantity, and as the war progressed, they needed help with everything, anti-aircraft guns, anti-aircraft shells, rifles, bullets. And so at first, though, that was the ironic thing. Winston Churchill came to the United States and was hoping to get all these, you know, just this treasure trove of armaments from the U.S., and he didn't even realize how weak the U.S. was, because the lack of weapons when you study the 30s is just amazing.
One of the interesting things is that Ross and I traveled to Russia in the early 90s, and we actually found some Lend-Lease material that was still in use to this day, in particular a motor. And it was really remarkable to see evidence of our past policy still in Russia.
Well, I find that interesting because we gave billions of dollars. It was something like $18 billion of equipment to Russia. And when you consider that the U.S. national debt going into World War II was $40 billion, that is, it took from the Revolutionary War, 1776, to 1941, to get a national debt of $40 billion. And then Roosevelt's giving, through Lend-Lease, $18 billion to Russia. It's a huge amount, and they used a lot of that, which we made during the war, of course. They got Lend-Lease against us in the Cold War afterwards, and apparently you and Ross discovered at least some of the equipment that remained more than 40 years after the war.
Yeah, and it worked perfectly. It was amazing.
It actually worked better than the Russian stuff.
Okay, interesting.
It worked better than the new Russian stuff. Yeah, which was pretty funny.
But that's back to the Americans winning the war themselves. The American manufacturers cared. It was not like, we don't care if we build good cars. We cared about that equipment. Almost everybody in the plants building that equipment had children or had nephews or friends in the war overseas. They wanted those friends to live and come back home. They were working as if their life depended upon it, because often they had children or friends whose lives did depend upon the quality of goods that were being made by Americans.
Well, you actually anticipated the question I was just about to ask you, which is, given that that Roosevelt had spent years calling capitalists or successful capitalists malefactors of wealth, as you say in your book, what exactly was their motivation? Some people who still don't like capitalists might want to ask you, hey, Bert and Anita, didn't these guys really just go make what Roosevelt wanted them to make for the war because they knew they were going to make a quick buck?
Well, there was certainly some of that, and there were some capitalists who were dishonest and produced shoddy weapons, and that gets into the story of Harry Truman. Harry Truman, who was going to be president later, is senator when the war begins, and he sees all of this shoddy workmanship at the new army bases, and he's concerned about it. He begins the Truman Committee to investigate both army plants, military plants, and any kind of materials being sent to the troops that is of poor quality. And Truman develops a huge reputation with the American people as the man who's trying to get the war industries to really do a first-class job. And he holds some hearings on Capitol Hill in 42 and 43 and throughout the war, and deeply embarrasses a few manufacturers who were not doing a good job, and people learn they have to take him seriously. But Bert was making a very good point, and that is that once the Nazis rolled through Europe in 1940, Americans were scared, and they were scared enough that they were willing to, one thing, reelect FDR to a third term. That's how he won a third term, because they didn't want to change horses with a European war on the horizon. And manufacturers of all kinds said, all right, we've got to manufacture the machines that are going to win this war.
So, again, we didn't get to it in this segment because we got into history, which I find absolutely fascinating. But what I want to ask you about, Bert and Anita Folsom, when we come back after this break, again, we're going to get right into this question of FDR using the emergency of World War II to increase federal government power. I want to talk to you about how exactly did he do that, and what were the long-run impacts of that? Because clearly we're still living with the results of FDR, not just what he did in the war, but during the New Deal as well. We're still living with all that big government. So stay with us right here on Backbone Radio, and don't forget, coming up at 7:05, Victor Davis Hanson. Stay with us.